This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Of course, we're getting close to the end of the school term. Summer vacation is looming in about another month for lots of North Dakota school kids. And we're going to talk about a program that helps sustain some kids and their families through the summer. It is the Summer Food Service Program. And we're going to talk about it with Linda Schlaer. She's the Director of Child Nutrition Programs for the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction. She joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Linda.
Hello.
Let's get the basics here. How big is this program?
In North Dakota, we have about 40 sponsors and about 100 sites statewide.
So when you say 40 sponsors and 100 sites, how many kids are being served?
For the whole year last year, we had about 95,000 breakfasts and about 175,000 lunches.
Wow.
It varies day to day.
Okay. So how does it work? How is the food distributed? How do people qualify and all that kind of stuff?
Well, the Summer Food Service Program is for low-income areas. So first of all, to be a sponsor, you have to serve an area where it's predominantly low-income households. And the sponsors then set up sites. And those sites also have to be in low-income areas to serve the low-income students, because the purpose of the program is to provide meals to students who are receiving free or reduced price meals during the school year, during the summer where they don't have access to their school meals.
So these aren't vouchers. These are actual meals. This is a central location where kids assemble to have the meal?
That's right. That's right. So the sponsors set up the sites, and then the sites prepare the meals and then may serve one meal or two meals every day. And at that time, then they advertise to the community so the kids know where and when they can go to get their meals.
So tell us about the sponsors. How does somebody become a sponsor, and what is the role of the sponsor?
The role of the sponsor is to basically operate that program. They coordinate setting up the sites. They make sure they have staff on hand, training. They take care of the financial aspects, pay the bills, receive the reimbursement, the money that they receive for the meals that they serve. They're kind of like the CEO of the program.
So how is this ultimately funded? Is this some of this government subsidized?
It's fully funded by the federal government under the United States Department of Agriculture. There is no state money that goes into the program. However, there may be local money that goes into the program. Plus, there's quite a bit of fundraising, like United Way does support the program in some areas as well.
Where does the food come from?
Well, the sponsors coordinate with the sites, and usually the food is prepared right at the sites. We do have many sites that are located in parks. So in that case, the food is prepared at a centralized kitchen, boxed up, packaged up, and then taken to the parks or other locations where it's being served.
So you've got 40 sponsors around the state of North Dakota, about 100 sites. Are there places that you need a site?
We really have problems getting sites in some of our rural areas, and that's because there's a low population. Of course, transportation is a problem, because in these rural areas, if they would have a site at a school, how do you get the kids from all those rural areas in the surrounding area to that school, at that set time to eat? So we do struggle getting our sites in some of our low-income rural areas.
So are there specific areas you'd like people to be aware of that you might need some sponsor support and some assistance?
Western North Dakota is really a problem.
Okay. How important is food support to these kids, to the educational mission of the Department of Public Instruction?
Well, you've heard this many times, that a child that is hungry can't learn. And that is so, it's the basics of survival. And, during the summer, certainly those kids aren't going to school, but they still, they need to eat. Many times these children have working parents, and so they're home probably taking care of other siblings or being taken care of by siblings. They don't have access to meal preparation, and if they do, the food they do have access to is probably sub you know, subnutritional. And so to have access to a place where they could go and have a meal, see their friends, maybe have some activities, it really kind of gives them something to do during the day other than sit in front of a screen.
Okay. Well, what kind of guidelines do you give the sponsors who are providing the meals?
Okay. So the meals have to it depends on what meal type it is, of course. But for lunch, it has to provide some type of a meat alternate, a bread or grain, a fruit or vegetable, and milk. And then breakfast is the same, only the meat alternate is not required. There has to be milk, some type of fruit or vegetable, and then a grain.
So you mentioned that you served something like 95,000 breakfasts last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's any guesstimate of how many kids that is for several breakfasts, you know, that kind of thing?
Oh, I not off the top of my head. I really
I'm
can't
just
tell
assuming
you.
That some kids would probably be there every day, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, yes. And our breakfast count went up 25% last year from the year before, which I think is remarkable. And the reason it went up is because it was actually being offered. So if I guess, you know, if you have food and you have a place where kids can go to eat, they will be there.
Well, how do you get the word out?
We do a lot of outreach. We send out information on our DPI website. The sponsors all are responsible for notifying their communities and their kids that have you know, the option of participating. So there's a lot of outreach going on at this time right now. They also try to do outreach like through the churches, through church bulletins, libraries. Sometimes they post things at grocery stores. There is an online, it's called the 211 network.
Yes.
Where people can, you know, text 211, and there's the mobile app that they can download and get information about the program and what's available in their area through that.
So there are lots of different ways you try to get the word out there.
Right. It's very important to make sure, you know, you can do whatever you want by setting up these meal sites, but you have to get that word out. We're finding that social media is extremely successful for getting the word out. If you can have a couple of parents put it on their Facebook page or on Twitter feed, then it just kind of blossoms.
Now, do you think that this 25% increase in just one year that you saw last year is a reflection of getting the word out, or is the need expanding?
I think it's getting the word out. I mean, the need is pretty stable here in North Dakota. We don't have a lot more children who are considered to be low income this year than any other year. But we have more sponsors, and our sponsors are kind of veterans. So they are learning as they continue to grow their own programs. We have a lot more sites, particularly in the eastern part of the state. The Fargo, West Fargo area has just, kind of really exploded for providing new sites, new locations, new opportunities for those kids to get, where it's closer to where those children live also.
Now, to be a sponsor, and you've mentioned that there's a wide variety of options for people who can be sponsors, what is the core commitment that needs to be made?
Well, they have to, first of all, be either a public school or a public organization such as a university. They can be a private nonprofit. We do have some parks and recs programs. We do have universities, like I said. I guess the main thing is they have to fall under some type of a umbrella organization. It couldn't just be, somebody off the street saying they want to be a sponsor.
So do you have to go – you mentioned Western North Dakota has a need for this. Is that an area you kind of go out to recruit to, or are you trying to get some – more support there?
Yes, we are. We every year we do some outreach. We send letters and information out to our private nonprofits in all areas in North Dakota where there's potential sites, because of course these sites have to be in low income areas. And then we get some questions, and we've had, some interest, and then when they find out about some of the commitments, or they look at the logistics. So many times it's just, how are we going to get these kids here? Because it is congregate feeding. You can't have people come and pick up a meal and take it away. They, you know, there's some requirements with that. So I guess our outreach in the western part of the state, we have worked somewhat with the YMCAs. The libraries are another area where we've done some outreach to.
How about oversight or review? I mean, are you traveling the state and kind of looking at these programs as they're happening?
Yes, we are. We have to review at least one-third of the programs every year. The programs that receive the largest amount of reimbursement for the meals, the programs that serve the largest number of meals, get reviewed more often. But we, you know, like I said, we have programs, many programs on the eastern part of the state, on the western part of the state. And they all operate between June and some go into August, but majority of our reviews have to be done in the month of June. So it's kind of a big lift for that month for getting things done.
Now, in many of these cases, would these kids be sort of going to the same school lunchroom they go to during the school year?
That's right.
So they're familiar with the place. They're familiar with how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wouldn't all these kids be from families that would, for the most part, qualify for food stamps?
Well, they're in areas where there's a large number of families that qualify, not for food stamps, but more for free or reduced price meals at schools.
Okay.
That's what we look at for determining low-income areas. We also look at census eligibility, but census eligibility is also based on number of kids eligible for free or reduced price meals. So it all boils down to that. But anybody can operate or participate. So if there's a site that's open in a neighborhood, in a community, anybody who wants to go and participate in the program can go. It's not the kids who go there do not have to prove that they are eligible for free reduced price meals or a low income. It's open to anybody who wants to come and participate.
Now, can these sponsoring organizations, if they have these relationships, work with a food bank?
Yes, and we actually have many of our sponsors that, the Great Plains Food Bank is a sponsor of several sites throughout the state.
So that's one way to access that. Is there planning in the future for maybe leveraging community gardens, things like that, other sources of nutrition?
There really hasn't been much conversation about that yet. However, through USDA, we have a program called Farm to Plate. It used to be Farm to School. Now it's called more like Farm to Plate. So there's always opportunities where we can promote using local foods and using planning menus that utilize what's available during the season.
Okay. So if you were to speak to the state, and you are right now, about the needs, the goals, the aspirations of the child nutrition program for the Department of Public Instruction, how would you lay that out?
Well, the Summer Food Service Program is very important to our state, to the children in our state, because so many children don't have access to those nutritious meals during the summer, especially in low-income areas. Our communities and our sponsors that operate the Summer Food Service Program have really taken upon themselves to make sure that the program is available to as many kids as possible. And, our job is to just help those sponsors do what they want to do and need to do and to meet the requirements of the program.
Well, you mentioned that the last year there was that big uptick in participation. What do you think the ultimate capacity of this program is? Have you factored that out? I mean, from 95,000 breakfasts to 150,000 or something like that?
We actually haven't looked at that. I think it's a matter of sitting down and really looking at where the pockets of need are yet and the number of children in that area, and then looking at the average participation. Certainly there is still room for growth. We see growth every single year, and I don't know.
To be determined.
To be determined. I'm sure when we talk to you next year, if we have the opportunity, we will have new numbers and higher numbers.
Well, we are looking at a number of options for feeding people in our state. We're working as Prairie Public with the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition, and this is just one of the themes that we're going to touch on every month through September of this year. So we want to thank you, Linda, for spending some time with us today.
You're welcome.
Linda Schler is the Director of Child Nutrition Programs for the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction. Coming up next, we're going to talk about ag runoff and climate change.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Woodhouse Restaurant of Bismarck, a locally owned family restaurant making the American classics from scratch since 1969 and offering homemade soup and pie specials daily.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. The news these days can be pretty tough, and it comes pretty fast, sort of like a fire hose, except what's coming out is not water. Sometimes you find yourself, perhaps, shouting things back at the news. And then on Saturday at 10 a.m. Central and 9 Mountain, you can tune in and hear the things you've been shouting at the radio on the radio. But we can only do it with your support by becoming a member of Prairie Public. Become one now by calling 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848 and then click on the link. And thanks.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A new study shows forests are really good at filtering contaminants out of water, but they're not catching everything. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports that an agriculture-related pollutant is getting through, and climate change is making it worse.
Two important parts of agriculture, fertilizer and animal waste, have a lot of nitrate in it. That's a nitrogen and oxygen mix that can cause serious health problems. Ann Schechinger is a senior analyst for the Environmental Working Group, a nonpartisan advocacy organization. She says even acceptable levels of nitrate in drinking water is a major threat.
And many newer studies have shown that drinking water with levels of nitrate at just 5 milligrams per liter or more can cause increased rates of cancer, such as colon, bladder, and ovarian cancer, as well as birth defects.
And if you think of the water cycle, nitrate is there. It's in rivers and streams. It's in the atmosphere. It's in rain. And as the number of severe storms and floods increase due to climate change, so does the speed of water carrying nitrate. The Yelton Spring in Missouri's Mark Twain National Forest is running strong. The cold, clear water is flowing rapidly out of a cave-like opening over rocks and fallen tree branches in what was a dry creek bed. Kelly Whitsett is a forest hydrologist at Mark Twain. She says it's been a very wet spring.
And surface-wise, it's from runoff into the streams during a precipitation event. You also have the subsurface influence where the springs carry water into the streams, too.
Whitsett says this water is moving quickly into streams and rivers that leave the forest and end up further along the watershed to other rivers and into groundwater aquifers. Heavy spring rains are the kind of events Stephen Sebastian says makes water move too fast. He's a research hydrologist with the USDA Forest Service. He says he always knew forests were good filters, but wanted to figure out how good. Sebastian says when water enters a forest, either through rain or runoff, the soil, leaves, and trees absorb a lot of stuff, and it leaves cleaner than when it came in. But he wasn't sure how well it filtered nitrate. So he studied 21 years of data from more than 100 streams in 10 states in the North and Midwest.
There were some particular short-duration events, rainfall or snowmelt events, when some of that atmospheric nitrate rapidly reached the streams, and those amounts were rather large.
Sebastian says as there are more severe storms and floods, more nitrate will move through water unfiltered. Schechinger with the Environmental Working Group says the study underscores the need to improve efforts to keep nitrate out of the water supply.
So we really believe that implementing agricultural conservation practices like edge of field buffers or cover crops or grassed waterways could prevent nitrate from getting into drinking water and just getting into our water bodies in the first place.
Schechinger says it can be costly to clean nitrate out of drinking water supplies. Des Moines, Iowa spent more than $15 million removing nitrate from its drinking water. She says preventative measures are cheaper. And researcher Sebastian says his findings should be causing policymakers to ask some basic questions about forests, water, and agriculture.
And if we can think about what we want forests to produce, how effective we want them to be in their production, and how much nitrate do we want to move through forests, this is where the information can be really important for folks.
Policymakers' next step, Sebastian says, should be looking at the data and figuring out how to reduce nitrates entering the water system. Then he'll be able to look at the numbers a few years from now and see how well those changes are working. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
If you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question, it's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via Facebook, where we are Main Street at Prairie Public. And you can still call toll-free 888-755-6377.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. One of the pluses of the climate where we live is the remarkable changes we witness within a year. Unlike some places in the world where the seasons are little more than dates on a calendar, at our latitude, the seasons are very distinct. In this week's Natural North Dakota, Chuck Lura celebrates signs of spring with his essay, Aspen Leaf Out.
Aspen, quaking aspen, or popple. Whatever you call it, it's the same species, Populus tremuloides. It's the most widely distributed tree species in North America. Here in North Dakota, if it hasn't been documented in all of the counties, it's close to it. It's the characteristic tree of the Turtle Mountains and can also be found in abundance in the Pembina Hills, Cheyenne National Grasslands, and around Devil's Lake. There's also scattered populations around western North Dakota, such as the Kildare Mountains and in draws and coulees of the Badlands. Around this time of year, when the trees are leafing out, I'm occasionally asked why the aspen in some areas are all leafed out, and in other areas they're just starting, or perhaps haven't begun. What's going on? Is it difference in soils or soil moisture? Environmental factors certainly influence the timing of various aspects of plant development, but in this case the differences are mostly genetic. Aspen seldom reproduces by seed. Seed viability is rather short, and the moisture and sunlight conditions for germination are quite restrictive. Even if the seeds do manage to germinate, browsing or trampling and a myriad of other factors may prevent them from becoming firmly established. However, once an aspen seedling becomes established, if given the opportunity, it generally reproduces vigorously from root suckers. Those root suckers grow outward from the parent plant to form new trees, forming a clonal stand that may cover several acres or more. All of those trees are connected underground. So when we see the aspen leafing out, it's not just one tree, but the whole clone that's leafing out. Oftentimes, different clones of aspen are nearby. So when we see the aspen leafing out in the spring, even the casual observer will often notice a patchwork of aspen stands at differing stages of leafing out. Each piece of the patchwork is a different clone. An aspen forest, then, is not a forest of individual aspen trees, but more accurately is a mosaic of patchwork of many aspen clones. Differences in the aspen leafing out is perhaps the most obvious characteristic for us to observe, but there's also many other genetic differences that are less noticeable. Each clone, for example, will be either male or female. If these differences are not apparent now, they will be soon. In most areas, a small clump of aspen is probably a single clone and will differ genetically from the other clones nearby. So as you travel the various areas of North Dakota this spring, make a point of observing differences in the development of the aspen. These clonal differences are easily observed and quite interesting. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about a North Dakota nonprofit that helps orphans in East Africa and the documentary that tells its story. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A fire this morning at Gordy's Service Center in Castleton. Firefighters from at least four communities were called to the blaze at around 5:30 this morning. Here's Castleton Fire Chief Tim McLean.
When the call came in, of course, we responded and found flame coming out of the windows. And the crews went in to extinguish it. And it got up into the attic area. And they ventilated, and, fire travels pretty fast when you get up in that area.
The cause of the fire is under investigation. The fire was in a separate building from the truck stop, convenience store, and Subway restaurant. Firefighters from Castleton, Buffalo, Mapleton, and West Fargo responded. Fargo is updating its renewable energy footprint with a plan that's expected to find new uses for the methane gas it has been capturing and selling to several sources since 2001. The methane, which comes from decomposing garbage at the city landfill, is collected in a series of 60 wells scattered throughout the landfill. Solid Waste Utility Manager Terry Ludlam says construction should be completed soon on a larger station housing new compressors and equipment to better treat the methane, which will create a quality natural gas product.
So I would think probably somewhere in the third quarter of this year, once the whole system is up and running, then I would sit down with other city leaders and elected officials and just maybe start discussing what some of the options are for that natural gas quality product. That could include fueling of our fleet. It could include more electric generators. We could use it as additional heating sources, some things.
Ludlam says the methane gas has been sold to the Cargill oil seed processing plant in West Fargo, 3 miles away, which uses it to fire its boilers. The methane also supplies power to the grid for Cass County Electric Cooperative through an electric generator. Ludlam says the gas, once wasted and the cause of a terrible odor, has been a moneymaker, bringing in $6.2 million from the sales. Since construction started on the project last year, the methane has been flared or burned off into the air as it cannot be stored. And with $50 million in funding from the state of North Dakota secured for the proposed Theodore Roosevelt Library and Museum to be built in Medora to match $100 million in private donations, where in Medora will the library be located? We posed that question to Governor Burgum.
What's been discussed with Interior is that they would actually knock down their 1960s visitor center and then rebuild a modern 2020s visitor center that would be incorporated with the library. You'd have a single campus that would include the visitor center, the welcome center, the presidential library, the museum, and so that if someone was visiting the park, then essentially this is what would greet them when they visited the park.
Burgum says he's also been talking with the National Park Service about making some improvements to the Painted Canyon Visitor Center on the east end of the park. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Cassie Shipley, Donor Relations Coordinator for Prairie Public. If you're a sustaining member, we can't thank you enough. Your generous monthly contribution provides a reliable source of funding so we can bring you high-quality programming and fact-based, independent journalism. Plus, you help bring down the costs of mailing out pledge reminders. And of course, it's greener for the environment. So we know you enjoy the little extra benefit of saving Prairie Public money. But here's where we could use your help again. Expired and renewed credit cards can stop a sustaining membership in its tracks. But that can't happen when you set up your monthly deduction via a checking account. So make the switch. All we need is your bank's routing number and your account number. That's it. So make your monthly gift to Prairie Public count even more by switching your sustaining membership to a checking account monthly deduction. It's easy to do. Just call me, Cassie Shipley, at 800-359-6900, extension 538, or email at sustainer@prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Deb Dawson. She's the producer of a new movie, a documentary about her nonprofit, African Soul American Heart. Thanks for being with us, Deb.
Thank you, Doug.
And also with us, Jessica Wunderlich. She is the director of the new movie, African Sojourn, a documentary, which tells the story of ASA, as we, you know, compress it sometimes. Jessica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Little background first, Deb. We've talked with you before about this nonprofit, but it's been years, so refresh our listeners' memories about what ASA is, African Soul American Heart.
Well, what ASA started as was a boarding school in South Sudan for orphaned girls, 32 girls at that time. Unfortunately, the war came there, and we had our kids fled, and we found them in refugee camps in three countries and moved them to Uganda.
So this has been going on for about 10 years
yes.
or so. And in the meantime, South Sudan, which was a brand new country, is now a brand new failed country.
That is correct. And there's still fighting going on. So our girls are now in a high quality boarding school in Kampala, the largest city in Uganda. They are from fourth grade to one girl in nursing school today. So we still have 43 kids in our program. We've had three graduate from college, two young men and one young woman.
This film, this documentary, recently premiered in Fargo, and it's going to Bismarck. It's going to be at the Dakota Stage at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, May 5th, and there'll be a reception later at David Borlaug's Capitol Gallery in Bismarck as well. Jessica, you got involved with Deb in this documentary years ago. Give our listeners a description of how you got tied up with ASSA.
Mm-hmm. I got a call from a friend of mine. She left a message on my voicemail saying, "Hey, girl, do you want to go to South Sudan for a month? I met this woman when I was there, and she needs someone to do some photographing." And I called her back, and she connected me with Deb. And this was 6 years ago. And Deb and I had a couple of phone conversations, kind of got the groundwork of what she was looking to have me do, which was follow her organization around for about 3 weeks in the middle of South Sudan and come and work in a place that had no electricity and stay in a mud hut and meet all these girls that she was educating in South Sudan. And I was on board immediately. I mean, before we talked about any of the logistics or anything, just pretty much ready to go. And I met Deb for the first time on the flight to South Sudan. We met in Minneapolis and kind of discussed the project from there.
And you live in Colorado. Mm-hmm. You're an independent filmmaker, and you've been doing this for a long time. Now this is kind of a labor of love of sorts, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Following these girls, the first trip that I took, I definitely, over the 3 weeks, fell in love with these girls and their motivation and their drive to really take this opportunity as far as they can. And that's when they lived in a little village in South Sudan, and the opportunities that they were maybe going to have in the future were pretty limited there. And when I went back with Deb the second time, that's when South Sudan had gone to war, and we were in Kenya for most of that trip. But I got to go into South Sudan and meet up with two of the girls who had fled the war. I went with them to enroll them in school with Dow, he was the program director at that time, I think, and he's amazing. And so in the middle of all of this, the first most important thing was to get them enrolled in school where they were at the time in the middle of fleeing for war. I was drawn in by that and went every opportunity that I had to follow through with the story.
So this nonprofit starts in Fargo, North Dakota, and it actually protects orphaned South Sudan girls displaced by war who've seen terrible things happen right before their eyes but are committed to their own education.
That's absolutely correct. And we have an opportunity for them in both in spite of and because of the war. We have moved to Uganda where we can safely house them and feed them and clothe them and so on, and we don't have to worry about attacks. But they're in a high-quality boarding school now. Their education levels have gone way up. We have some kids who are absolutely top students in their classes, and they're competing with Ugandan students and even some kids from other countries who have parents who are international and have enrolled them in a boarding school.
These young women and girls, in some cases, really embody true grit, the experiences they've had, and yet their commitment to changing their lives and affecting others, I think, as well.
Well, our mission is that we protect these girls from, you know, disease with vaccinations and injuries and things like that. We educate them in school subjects and practical life skills, and we empower them to be leaders and give back to their communities. So that's the expectation, and they are, from when they're young, they can recite our mission, so they know that they have an obligation, you know, to do for others when they finish our program.
So they'll be paying it forward.
Yes.
Jessica, you were filming in a very difficult place, challenging in terms of the environment and, of course, the circumstances in some cases. Talk about the process of gathering what was hours and hours and hours of stuff and making an hour and a half documentary about it.
It's a big undertaking that I was maybe a little ambitious taking on initially, powering the gear with a little solar panel. I'm a one-person crew in a situation like that, so I'm running the camera, miking people, mixing the audio, dealing with lighting, setting up interviews, all of this. I mean, I'm doing it all, but it becomes just natural. It's like you just are living it when you're in it for 3 weeks. And then Deb was working as the producer in the field too, mm-hmm. so wrangling people to do the interviews and any other little piece that I needed help with, she was there.
And this is a country that we learn in the documentary has 70 miles of paved roads in the entire country.
Yes, of South Sudan, that's true. Still true.
And it's still a dangerous place, literally.
Yes. In fact, the village that our school is located in within the past year has had additional attacks and people killed. And one of our girls lost her last remaining relative, an aunt who was killed. And so, you know, our kids are still experiencing trauma because of we get messages. They go to a church service in Kampala they have a Sudanese church service, and they get to interact with their community there because mostly they're separate from them. And so we want them to retain those ties. But they get news of the things that are happening in South Sudan that way as well.
And I've had the good fortune to have gone now twice to
yes.
Uganda to see what this looks like. And it is amazing and humbling to see it, to be sure. And it's also interesting to be in a country, Uganda, a country of 40 million people, that now has about 1.5 million people from South Sudan who literally crossed the border for refuge.
That's absolutely true. In fact, the world's largest refugee camp in 6 months went from no people to 285,000, and it's now the world's largest refugee
And that's right
camp.
On the border. Of
right on the border. It was very close to where we were located, and it was impacting our ability to get power and water to our compound where the girls were living, and they went to local schools. We thought there might be some danger to them, just as being Sudanese girls wandering around the town now that there was such a large refugee population. So that's when we decided to move them to Kampala, to a bigger city, and put them in boarding school.
Jessica, you did all these interviews, some of them with Deb, actually talking with people who lived in the village about what was going to happen to their daughters, their girls. That is some of the most important and, I think, interesting material in the documentary, the actual conversations you have with people about what's going to happen to these girls. What's it like to be involved in a discussion, a life-changing discussion like that?
Well, some of the parts of this film that were left on the cutting room floor are some of the most valuable things, I think, going back to the village in South Sudan and the opportunities that Deb and I had to talk with village elders and the guardians and just so many people in that community about growing up without an education and what it meant to educate the few girls that Deb's able to bring along. And it was an amazing outpouring of support. Culturally, the education isn't available for the girls, but the support is there. And they were, the men and the women and just everyone in the community was incredibly excited about this, how the girls would in the future, how they would develop new systems and make life easier and bring the whole community up. So in that, like discovering that every opportunity that one person gets in those communities is looked at as a giant family. Everybody's going to be lifted up by lifting up one girl or 43 girls or 50 girls. So it's a huge pay it forward system.
And this is a very different culture. For our listeners, describe what the status of girls and women was in what was formerly Sudan and now is South Sudan.
Well, given that Juba is the capital and the largest city in South Sudan and still not very large, and most people live in a rural lifestyle where they have cattle, they grow some crops or whatever they're able to grow depending on the landscape where they are. But a lot of the area we were, it's kind of like Fargo, it's pretty flat. You have rivers that flood, lots of flooding in that community as well. When we first started going there and trying to determine who needed help, girls were the most vulnerable of the people in the village. And girls are likely to be forced to marry at a young age orphan girls, nobody had ever heard of them going to school, because really the value to the family member who has taken over the care of maybe several children of a deceased family member, you know, they're going to activate the cattle dowry when as soon as the girl hits puberty.
That means basically sort of sell the girl into marriage.
And then she moves into a different family, and that's, you know, was typical there. And we thought we wanted to break that cycle, that girls shouldn't, first of all, be married as youngsters. There's an old man in the film that is quoted, Gideon Dow, who just passed away this year. And so he was in his late 90s. But he was a school teacher years and years ago. They did not have girls in school, but he was fully supportive. And he'd been listening to a radio and heard that a 15-year-old girl was being married. And he said, that's wrong. You know, they shouldn't be doing this. So even a guy in his 90s could see that this was a bad practice to marry underage girls. So
that does come across very strongly in the documentary, that there seems to be this awareness that things need to change.
Well, and unfortunately, a lot of people are living in refugee camps now from South Sudan, including relatives of our girls and so on. So life has changed.
So how does this enterprise sustain itself? I mean, you're in Fargo, and the girls are in Kampala, Uganda.
Yes. It sustains itself by the generous people that live in this community and others where we have people that, for whatever reason, know about what we're doing and have chosen to support us. I really feel grateful to Fargo-Moorhead and around other areas of North Dakota as well, and Minnesota, that have helped us get to where we are, because it takes money to do that.
Yeah.
And in Uganda, we rely on our two staff members, Dow and Daniel. They so much love our kids. Both of them have children of their own. Both of them have only one wife and only intend to have one wife, because this is the other thing. There's multiple, you know, a wealthy man with lots of cattle can marry as many as he wants and then produce as many children. And that is how value in the old days was determined. But people now want education. And our girls as orphans are standing up as examples of what can change for people in a whole community if you have educated people there.
And the ASA girls are, I think, aware of their status, of their unique qualities, the fact that there aren't many people like them in education in that part of the world.
That it's very true.
What's the future for African Sojourn, which again will be shown at the Dakota Stage at 3 p.m. Sunday, May 5th, and then there will be a reception at the Capitol Gallery in Bismarck. So what's the future for a documentary like this?
I mean, the hope is that people do get to see this and are inspired to support education for girls around the world. That's the primary point. It's what I discovered is very important there.
And as Deb, as you've mentioned, you know, you've been doing this for quite a long time now. Mm-hmm. There are 43 girls that still need to finish their education. So this is a personal commitment that is deep.
Yes, it is. I, you know, they all call me mommy. Every single one of them calls me mommy. I'm old enough to be their grandmother, but they look at me in that role as a mother who is providing for them. And so it's a privilege and a responsibility.
Considering the fact where they are, it's not inexpensive, obviously, to run a nonprofit from Fargo to Uganda, but a dollar does go a fair distance in that part of the world.
Yes, we're actually fortunate to be in Uganda, because at this point in South Sudan, the money is worth like nothing anymore. The money's so devalued in South Sudan. But Uganda, a dollar goes a long way, and we are very fortunate to live in that country. And plus, they say Uganda is the friendliest nation in the world. People are very welcoming. We haven't really ever had any bad experiences with people in Uganda.
And likewise,
our girls.
And the nation is filled with refugee camps.
It's filled with refugee camps. Refugee camps are both a burden and a responsibility for a community, but it also brings development. You know, refugee camps bring people, NGO workers, they bring food supplies, they build hospitals or clinics and schools, and local people are able to take advantage of some of the things in camps. But that doesn't mean there's not tension.
Jessica, how'd you get into this business of creating documentary, full-length documentaries, at no less? I mean, tell us about your career arc.
This was an accident. I started as a still photographer. And I've always looked for stories that are giving a voice to people who don't necessarily have the mic and compel other people to make a difference. And I started making short films. I worked in Israel in 2006. Conflict started there while I was there, and I stayed. And then I've just ended up in a few places where, like the Boston Marathon bombing and...
You were there?
I was there at the finish line, and I've just sort of been in those places, and I find that I can work when things are a little crazy around me.
Well, you seem to have an objective, though. There's something you want to have happen from your work.
I hope that people are inspired to see that even in places around the world where others don't have very much, and we might see from the outside, the reporting is covering conflict and desperation and poverty, but people are resilient and full of heart, and people are giving and working together, and there is so much dignity and grace, and everybody deserves a chance, and just looking at the devastation around the world is exhausting, and I think that it's worth looking at some of these stories where people kind of rise up. They're doing it every day, and it shouldn't be such a unique thing to see in the media. So I'm hoping to kind of share that.
Well, it is unusual, I think, for somebody on the other side of the world to decide, you know, I'm just going to help some kids that I've never met, but now whose lives are closely intertwined with yours.
True. My first trip there, I thought that would be the only trip. We made a documentary. Jessica was not with us at that time. I had some people from Fargo. Greg Carlson was involved, and Matt McGregor was our cameraman. And we made a documentary to tell the original story, which was about a lost boy, Joseph Acole McKeer, in our community of Fargo, who came here as a young person with his younger siblings and raised them and supported them and graduated from NDSU. He's now coordinator for NGOs working in the country. And so because he returned to South Sudan after he graduated from college, then there was nobody that I thought he was the one that was going to go back and forth and see how things were going there. And I would just make that one first trip. And when it turned out that wasn't going to happen, well, I just couldn't let it go. I'd met these people. And so then I've been there like 25 times, I think.
That's Deb Dawson. She is the producer of African Sojourn, a documentary about African soul, American heart. And that's the nonprofit that she's been running for about a dozen years now that helps girls, orphan girls from South Sudan, get an education and realize a real life. And Jessica Wunderlich is the director of the motion picture that is being shown again Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Dakota Stage in Bismarck, and then there's a reception afterward at the Capitol Gallery. Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
One more thing I'd like to add. I am open to, if there is a church in the community or anybody that wants to see it, I'd come and show it to them.
I know, because I've seen you do it. That's Deb Dawson. More Main Street in a moment.
Where do you listen to Prairie Public? In the shower? On a
bicycle,
while you're walking the dog, in the car, on a plane, train, scooter? I'm guessing you listen to Prairie Public in a lot of places doing a lot of things, so that means you listen to Prairie Public a lot. Think about it. And help support your source for enjoyable, educational, and non-commercial listening experiences that broadens your perspectives and connects you with the world. Make an easy monthly sustaining membership contribution by calling 800-359-4145. You can also go to prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848 and open the link we send. Thank you for all the ways you listen to Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 29th. On this date in 1910, the Devil's Lake Interocean newspaper wanted to make sure that all North Dakotans were counted in the census. There was a great deal riding on it. A sufficient increase in the population would mean North Dakota would get an additional seat in Congress. That would raise the number of representatives in the House from 2 to 3. Even though the date of the census had passed, the newspaper urged citizens to contact the census enumerator if there was a chance they were missed. There was still time to make a correction and be sure that every North Dakotan was accounted for. Congress introduced legislation providing for the 1910 census in 1907, but it was held up until 1909. There was a conflict between President Teddy Roosevelt and Congress over how to hire enumerators to oversee the process. Roosevelt said they should be hired through the civil service system. Congress insisted they should be patronage positions, as was traditional. To no one's surprise, Roosevelt won the argument. There were some changes for 1910. Census day was changed from June 1st to April 15th. The Census Bureau was afraid that too many city dwellers would be away on vacation in June. The legislation also authorized funds for a permanent Census Bureau. New positions included an assistant director, a geographer, and a chief statistician. The 1910 census faced significant challenges. Automatic equipment to tabulate the results actually slowed the process. Eventually, bulletins were released with information that was still incomplete. Some results, such as the population of cities, were put out in brief press releases. It was a year before the final results were published. The results of the census did indeed show a population increase for North Dakota. The population in 1900 was just under 320,000. In 1910, the population had increased to more than 577,000. As hoped, the increase was enough to gain a third seat in Congress. But in 1930, the state lost a representative, and in 1970, it lost another. Today, the state continues to have just one lone representative. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Dave Thompson. North Dakota is a unique place to live. It is unique because we have oil, we have wind, we have coal, we will potentially have other forms of energy. Plus, we have a very big dependence on agriculture. It truly is a fascinating state to cover. It is a challenge to tell news on a statewide news network because we're always looking for stories that might be interesting to listeners in Wahpeton and Williston, Bisbee to Bowman. And we have to choose that. Red River Valley News will interest people in Bismarck because the Red River Valley is the population center, and with the proposal to bring Missouri River water to Fargo, there are a lot of things that tie our state together. And that's what it's all about. Why should listeners get their statewide news from Prairie Public? It's because we endeavor to tell as many sides of the story as we can. We also endeavor to do what Charles Osgood once said was the challenge of broadcast news, and that's making the important story interesting and the interesting story important. Listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk about life insurance with a person who knows a bit about it. Dan Hagland is an agent, and you may not have known it, but later this week, Thursday, is National Life Insurance Day. So we'll get the lowdown on life insurance on Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.